All righty. You want to do the intro this time?
Nope.
All right.
All you.
Hi there. This is Ron and Cindy Gula with another episode of the Gula Tech Cyber Fiction Show. Cindy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Ron. How are you doing?
Doing very well, because today our guest is Richard Thiem. Cindy and I have known Richard for a long time. I think long time becomes more of an insult or something like that after a while, right? But ages, right, Richard? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And yeah, it's been decades, not years.
That's right. So today we are going to talk about Richard Thiem's background, which is 25-time DEF CON speaker, author of multiple books, including works of fiction and works of science fiction and works of nonfiction, which is good stuff. So let's start off with DEF CON and Black Hat. So Richard, this is the first year you're not there in person. How has DEF CON changed over the years?
Well, just about. I didn't go last time, but I did go to Hope, which was a reasonable facsimile thereof. It's been 25 years of DEF CON. How has it changed? Well, I pre-recorded the talk this year and sent it to them because I just couldn't risk Vegas for 4 days for a variety of reasons. DEF CON, the first time I went, it was thanks to Jeff Moss. He has a genius for creating the desire to participate in his agenda, because all those goons can't wait to sign up to pay their way. We're not well compensated to speak at DEF CON, but we wouldn't miss it for the world. My first one was 1976, DEF CON 4. 375 people in total at the con. And what I called the kids. They were young. They were real hackers. They could still get away with everything and know they wouldn't be prosecuted because they weren't 21, but they could get a slap on the wrist. They couldn't get online as easily and cheaply as we can today. They couldn't store stuff as easily and cheaply as we can today. To get on the internet, you had to go through, one of your son's servers at school or something. Nobody could afford it. And now it's cheap and ubiquitous, and you know the story. But they had to be good at figuring it out. And once they found the play space, they played. They made it a big toy, and it became the big toy, for better or worse, for all of us. So Jeff put a notice out on the internet, which was new, relatively, and said, I need somebody to keynote DEF CON. So I said, I've been speaking for 3 years about technology, 4 years. I could do that. And as I say, his genius was, okay, let's try you. And the way he does it is, if it works, come back. And if it doesn't, thank you. So I went and keynoted DEF CON. And what Kim Zetter said to me, a really solid journalist, the first time she heard me there, was people got that I respected them. I knew who they were. I knew who I was and how I could link to that emotionally. We were all, in a way, lost boys, Peter Pan style. And it became clear over time that having brought my previous history as a clergyman to that, but without religiosity, if you will, it helped to create bonds and availability. And people needed someone to talk to. And we became very, very close, a lot of them. And that's also where I met for the first time many people from NSA and CIA who were there, sometimes undercover, sometimes not, who became very close friends and colleagues because we were all older. I was early 50s when I did that.
How do you feel about going from spot the Fed to invite the Fed to keynote?
Well, It's one of the major arcs of the thing. I could name the different moments along the way when all of a sudden Microsoft and everybody showed up handing out business cards. And instead of being hackers, suddenly the kids realized, oh my God, there's big money in this. Well, a lot of people figured that out. It's kind of a little sense of humor. So, like being a change agent. If you're in cybersecurity, you got a lifetime job. Because as one of my friends said, everybody, he looked at the whole panoply of vendors and said, every single one is selling something they can't deliver, which is security. complete security. And they have a tendency to exaggerate what you're buying. So as you know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry and it's not going to go away. And I said in that very first DEF CON talk, you are going to be the thought leaders of the 21st century. And then 2 years ago, when I saw Olive Loft up on stage, there they all were. And a lot of them are thought leaders, and sometimes implicitly so, by virtue of creating the space in which everybody in the world now lives and moves and has their being, to quote an old prayer, without often knowing it. And that was something I saw early on, that they were creating a context that was going to transform every aspect of life. And so now, you know, so the 375 then, what is it, 30,000, 40,000 a couple of years ago? Who knows how to count how many people are there crowded into 3-4 hotels, whereas before it used to be one hotel. And Jeff said to me early on, we chose Vegas because it was the only city building hotels faster than we could use them up. Because in those days, they were never invited back. Once you put concrete in the toilet and a fake bomb under a car and taken over the, you know, the code on the elevator, and it always stops at 7, no matter where you want to go, and take over the security wireless network and move people back and forth across the hotel lobby and laugh. It should make us smile, was the old hacker mentality. But now it's not that. And it grew into DEF CON. I mean, into Black Hat. And so, yeah, the first year I was there, they were talking about we should do something. And I advanced that notion. We should make what's available in your expertise for people who need to learn it. And the next year was the first Black Hat. And I keynoted that Black Hat and another Black Hat that was always at the Hacker Court. And the last Black Hat I spoke at, I did a talk called Staring into the Abyss, the Dark Side of Security and Intelligence Work. And I guess the best comment was somebody said, you know, people were really accepting of that talk, considering that you told them that they were all full of shit. And that's an exaggeration on his part. But I can tell you, it was the only time I was having dinner with Kim Zetter and Simple Nomad at Caesars. And the waiter came over and he said, that gentleman over there is buying your dinner. And I didn't know who it was. And he said, he just wanted to thank you for that talk. Because the clarity with which I articulated the larger context of the economic structures of the world and how hacking and security played into them was pretty clear. It was also the last time I spoke at Black Hat, because Jeff sold it, and then it became a mini RSA. And once the vendors are running the show, their agenda is a lot different than, can we find somebody who transcends what we're selling in order to build a big picture for people? No, that's not what they want.
Your experience as a clergyman, sort of selling religion, you know, telling people all about religion, was it you were able to pivot from that to talking about cybersecurity?
Well, what being in the religious business gives you, if you're doing it right, first of all, there's part of it that's genuine or you wouldn't get into it. I had a life-changing experience many, many years ago in England, which reformed or transformed my understanding of who I was. Forget the content of the religion in relationship to the ground of being itself. I belonged to the world and the universe in a different way. And once that happens, I called it a hierarchical restructuring of the psyche. There are a lot of things that can trigger it. And once it happens, I think we're all hardwired to have that experience. But once you have it, then what a religion does is provide a narrative that purports to make sense of what you experienced in terms of their narrative. And that's why there are diverse narratives. And if they get you quickly and love bomb you and bring you into the fold, it is very difficult to separate that narrative from the transformational process itself. But I had that gift. I could do that. And I did ministry in 3 different cultures, Hawaii, Utah, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And each one required you to see the metaculture in order to relate to people out of who they genuinely were and what they were presenting. So to go to cybersecurity, it sounds crazy, but it was just an easy pivot because there were people living on the edges, as I had lived on the edges all my life. And when you live on the edges, and I was a minority in 6 different ways, which is unusual for a guy who looks like me, right? and all minorities, whatever the content of their minority status, which is always designated by the dominant culture. Nobody calls themselves a minority, learns to live and be effective on the edge, because it's worth your life sometimes to see clearly what people in the dominant culture really mean by what they do, not by what they say. And that was my whole life long, religious, racial, and cultural minority in different ways. And I found out when I moved to Milwaukee and I was mistaken for someone who belonged to the dominant culture, that I had thrived on the edges because it was so natural. You know, being raised as a Jew in Chicago, being a Gentile in Utah, being a Haole in Hawaii, that was all natural. And when people started treating me as if I belonged, it was a huge aha as to how the dominant culture so totally treats its members differently in all sorts of spoken and unspoken ways and opens all sorts of doors. Women know this from the ground floor up. Jews know it. Blacks know it. People of color know it. Gays know it. And well, so...
Really, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because from a point of view of being on the edges, and here you have DEF CON and hackers who thrive on the edges, and then all of a sudden they're embraced by the dominant technology and try to be put into a box.
Yeah.
And it just the dynamic of the way some people like fit and other people who completely shunned the idea, but it overtook them anyway.
Right. Right. They couldn't stop the tide. First the pioneers and then the merchants. The pioneers settled the territory, and then in the stagecoach with plush seats, here come the tradespeople, and pretty soon they're buying up ranches and so on and so forth. It's just the way of the world. It's how things work. So some adjusted to that, and some didn't so well. Some had to continue to be outlaws and outliers, if you will. And I know people who did that. They couldn't stand making a lot of money in a wonderful industry that was just like other industries in America, because somehow that's so ground against the grain of who they thought they were. And I understand that completely because I've reinvented myself three different times. And each one required that I create a persona that was good enough to present, to facilitate information and energy flowing between me and other people. And bringing the ministry to it, what that was the kind of empathy and compassion that took me into the ministry and made me successful. When I left, I was being offered bishop and the biggest churches in the Episcopal Church. And I realized I would suffocate to death if I took them for exactly the reasons you're saying. All the details are flooding my mind. What it took at the age of 49 to say, when the biggest church in our country came for an interview and called up and said, "We don't understand." He said, "You have everything we want in what we call a rector." He said, "Except one thing keeps nagging us." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "We keep getting the feeling that you don't want us." And I said, "Bingo, I'm out. Take my name off the list." And I called the bishop's group that was coming from Connecticut. "Take my name off the list. I'm out of here." Because to allow myself to be assimilated at that level of success on the East Coast, in an East Coast elitist church, would have prevented me from doing the kind of exploring on the edges that has been the driving dynamic of my life, and which I love.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. I mean, especially with recruiting more people into cybersecurity, and more specifically, directly, the hackers.
Right.
You know, it's always just that love of exploring the unknown, or that thing that you shouldn't. You'd been told you shouldn't do, and right. You know, that's the first thing. That's an invitation to
right. You know. That rush. I mean, you guys. I mean, I dare not presume your histories, but some people know the rush. I mean, I remember way back when you could just get on the internet for the first time, and I found, do you remember, Usenet group, and it said if you take your scanner and take the back off and find this capacitor and clip it, you will be able to listen to all the cell phones and calls, cordless phone calls in your area. And I clipped it. I called it reality radio. That's in Mobius too, the young guy who does that. But there's a part of you that just loves listening in, right? And my wife didn't like it. She said, I don't want to know that. He smiles. He cuts his grass. He waves. He says, how are you? I don't want to know he's a rabid racist or anti-Semite or a Yahoo. I said, well, it's better to know what's real because then you can deal with reality.
Yeah.
Instead of having to spend so much time and effort to walk from here to reality just to begin the conversation.
How have you seen the culture change? You know, we're talking about hackers becoming business leaders, you know, coders becoming team leaders. You know, with that, with the backdrop that cyber now can really impact people's lives, right? We had SolarWinds, we had Colonial Pipeline. We've had some major, major things impact our economy and country now.
Oh, it's huge.
It got real, real.
Yeah. And I was just reading, you did, you talked to Peter Singer.
Peter, right? Singer, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, so that sparked me to read all of his books. And Like Wars, there's a chapter in Like Wars, which does an incredibly good job of bodying forth for people to understand that what war is now is different. And as I say, I met a lot of people and I worked with them in different ways. I wrote a paper for an unnamed agency in the 90s, illuminating how the very nature of intelligence was changed by that as the borders around nation states and identity. A lot of my work is identity one way or another, even my novels. And my whole life, as I said, has been fashioning identities. And yes, cyber has what we call cyber in the aggregate is a huge sea change for the culture. And we haven't got our heads around it. Some know how to exploit it. I mean, I can give you all the examples. You know what they are. But we don't have a system of governance for a digital society. We're still operating out of industrial society governance. It doesn't fit. And that's one of the reasons our political discourse is so at odds with our experience in reality, because people are still speaking in 20th century frames, and those frames don't fit. And the worst, most egregious examples, I remember somebody went to a subcommittee in the Senate to try to show somebody what a little of this was like. And he set up a MacBook, and the senator stood there and looked at it and he said, hello? Hello? I mean, clueless. To ramp up from that level of cluelessness to grasping what this is really liberating for society, and that they're going to be winners and losers. The United States could very well be a loser, but that's a whole other conversation if we don't do this right.
Yeah, I'm always surprised, and it's people who are not in cyber. And they say, hey, what about this, you know, last hack or Colonial Pipeline? I said, well, you know what? The dirty little secret in cybersecurity is we applaud those when they happen because that gets your attention. Right. And it's just, you know, the vast majority of people who are just not paying attention. It's not like we cheer them on or want to see them, but it really does take a negative impact to somebody's personal life in order to get them to pay attention.
That's right. Like a conservative is a liberal who is mugged, right? that's the way it is. But also we've contributed to all, you know, we play all the sides. And Mobius is real clear on that. And I'm real clear on that. That nation states as the sole arbiter of your identity is just not true anymore. And there is a whole other world, like Lando Calrissian's Cloud City or whatever it was, floating above this world. It has different rules, not different laws, because they don't have laws, but they have different rules. And they've created an alternative society for the economy and for laundering money and for all sorts of what we call illicit activity. And yet a Senate hearing that I like to quote showed that if all the money was taken out of the American economy that is from illicit drug trade, illicit weapons trades, drug trades, and trafficking, the economy would tank overnight. And that's part of what my Staring into the Abyss talk back then was about, is be real. Who are these banks? Who's doing the money laundering on whose behalf? Just be real about the gray world. That's the key thing. And hackers are great at seeing gray everywhere because it's just not black and white. And to go back to your reference to religion, those that think it's black and white, you know, are captive in a rigidity that is life-denying and inauthentic because it's not black and white. It's gray. And I remember years ago, one of those first DEF CONs, when a young hacker told me he had found an exploit, and he got a call from one of the agencies and said, please don't reveal that because we find that so useful in our work. Well, you know, we know, a lot of people listening to this know how that works. We didn't need Snowden to tell us what was going on. We know what's going on. And so you don't have the luxury of a moral high ground. And, you know, so the religion world is not what people think. When you start out, if you have any judgmental qualities, if you really listen to the person in the chair who comes to talk to you, and you don't wind up with compassion and an understanding that if you had been them with the same inputs into their life that you have, your life that they had, that you would do exactly the same thing, you have no moral high ground. Compassion and empathy, it's the name of the game. And so that's reported to my work with all over the world. As you know, I'm speaking and learning. Every time I go to one of the conferences, I learn more than everybody else because I'm dumber than everybody else. I know less going in. And so I listen, and all that wonderful wisdom and knowledge comes downhill to me. And it's just, are my arms big enough to catch it all and take it home? And above all, the gift is to get it, integrate it, synthesize it, and then articulate that synthesis in a way that's meaningful and powerful for people. And that's where all these years of, you know, 28 years of speaking, 16 years in ministry, and before that, 5 years teaching literature at the University of Illinois. Talk.
Well, one of the things you're good at is you've organized the things you talk about. And one of the things I Cindy and I wanted to talk to you about is this concept of what does it mean to be an expert? Because so many people want to get into cybersecurity, but they really don't know what that means. And there's tons and tons of experts out there with all sorts of bad advice on right. why their career field is the right thing for them, regardless if it's a woman, a minority, whatever. So where are you with experts in cyber these days?
When anything becomes this big, you can sell snake oil. You know that. And there's a lot of snake oil in any industry that people don't understand, but somehow is bound up with their fear and they think they need something. And we're seeing that across the political spectrum now. So there are real experts. But one thing I learned in speaking is if you don't know something, don't go there. Know what you know what you do not know. And don't try to pretend that you know what you don't know. And that's where the authenticity can come from. But it does take requiring close listening to what people are telling you on both an emotional, if you will, spiritual level. What are their real questions? What do they really need? You know, and I grew up in Chicago working for the Daily Machine to get through Northwestern, and I learned an awful lot. And Daly would have people attack him all the time. And he'd say, come on in the office. And he'd say, what do you need? And after a while, he'd say, yeah, okay, but what do you really need? And when they got what they really needed, they turned into Democrats. They loved Mayor Daly. They came out for a photo op with their arms around each other. And I learned that don't buy the moralizing. And moralizing in cybersecurity is the proclamation of things that people should know better that they do not know how to do and cannot promise. Know the limits of what you do. You know, you created a terrific product that is still extolled far and wide in the world, but you never pretended it could do everything. You said clearly what it could do and why it had value being able to do that.
It's funny. I mean, people at pitch us companies, we had to come up with 5 rules of pitching us, right? Tell us the problem you solve. Tell us how you solve it all the way to, you know, what does success look like for you? Because right. A lot of times people who are even asking for money and funding don't know how to answer those kind of questions.
Right.
But maybe Richard, when people come to you after a conference and they say, hey, I want to get into cybersecurity. What do you tell them?
Okay. I don't think people say that. I'm trying to think of a single time if they're either already in it or they just want to know about it and how it impacts their life, but it never occurred to them that they could get into it as a career. People are drawn to it for all sorts of reasons. And you say with the big arc where DEF CON has come down now with all the Alphabet certifications that people are amassing, and everybody knows they can be helpful, but they don't take you where you need to go. And, you know, you mentioned to me earlier a talk I do, Computers Breaking the Rules and Huckleberry Finn, and I'll allude to that because I looked at what expert systems early on tried to do. And the naive approach was to codify the wisdom of experts into heuristics and then provide them in a whole set of this, then that rules that a non-expert could use then to arrive at expert conclusions. And they discovered that there were certain domains, you know, like mining, looking for ore, medical, some, where people could use that kind of template. But they found real experts, you know, beginners need black and white rules. And you're told, just don't break the rules. Just stay with it until you get a body of knowledge and experience where you can say, well, I know the rule is, but I'm not sure. And then when they looked at the domains where this just didn't apply at all, it was because real experts break the rules all the time. And the difference is they know when to break the rules. So I concluded there's only one rule, which is if you don't know when to break the rules, don't break the rules. In other words, remain on the sliding scale back down toward a black and white understanding of what works until you develop the intuitive knowledge, which we're calling expertise, that enables you. And it is intuitive because if you're asked for heuristics that they can encode with your wisdom, you can't get it. You can't get it.
How do you think that bodes for this, the same thing being done with AI?
Oh, AI is, we mentioned Terminator in one of our exchanges, and it's really no joke, right? I think, and this is where I say, what do I know? But on the basis of who I talk to, what I read, the Chinese are still not quite up to or ahead of us in AI, but boy, are they trying hard. And they knew what they were doing. They knew where they wanted to go. I remember reading the kernels, Chinese kernels, decades ago, and they said, this is where we want to be in 50 years. And then they execute, even though the political vagaries may cause a zig and a zag, they're pretty much doing it. And people who saw what the Chinese were going to build in terms of military prowess and ability, I think undersea is one area where they're not quite where we are. And that's what Ghostfleet was about. And they're trying very hard to catch up with that. But people who did this analysis said they took it to military planners and said, this is what you need to be worried about. These were China experts at CIA. And they were told, look, I've got two wars to fight right now. Don't tell me what I'm going to be fighting in 10 years. I haven't got time for it. But they have the long view. And AI, as I suspect you know, is absolutely going to transform how we relate to our machine masters. Because we already ask our machine masters to make decisions for us. And you can think of all the different ways, the appliances we use. And that's when I knew the internet was disappearing. Because it's like I plug in a toaster. I don't say to my wife, I'm going on the power grid now. Say I'm going to toast these toasts now. Once you have appliances that are named in relationship to the task they perform, the background context that enables them to exist, like the grid, disappears. And I saw that happening with the internet. So I said, the kids are going to be socialized. This is a while ago, socialized by the world that is coming to be, aren't going to talk about the internet. And they don't, because they're always on the internet. The internet is everywhere. They don't say I'm going on the internet, but it wasn't long ago that old people like you guys and me, we said, I'm going to go online. I'm getting on the internet. Well, A lot of young people don't know any kind of life that's off the internet, and they don't see what's going on behind the scenes. They don't see the code. They don't see the manipulation.
And the code and the manipulation and the language that we all use, cyber, what is cyber? And then, you know, cybersecurity. So even when we say cybersecurity to kids, I don't think they have an idea of what in totality we're talking about or why it's important, because we don't say the why.
No, I think you're right. And part of that is values have fundamentally shifted. I remember being asked by a college in Milwaukee to talk to they were all in their 50s, professors, and they were upset about plagiarism. And I said, don't you understand? There's no plagiarism. There's cut and paste. Plagiarism is when documented material is falsified as if it's your own. But when it's flowing in and out of your brain all the time, and there's no documentation, I know people are trying, but part of the problem we're having with meme warfare, memetic warfare, is people can't distinguish between something that's viral and something that's true. And I had professors tell me that their students don't know. And in terms of literature, I have people think a novel is a book. They don't know it's a work of fiction and that there is a category called nonfiction. And this is mind-boggling for an old man, right? And yet I go back to the first column, Islands in the Clickstream, that I wrote was in response to a professional engineer magazine in Wisconsin. And they said, people are asking us about cyberspace. They want to know, what is this thing called cyberspace? So I wrote that column. They said, oh, they love that. Do another. Well, pretty soon those columns became my first book, and it was published when I was 60 years old. And here at 77, excuse me, I just published my seventh book. So the lesson there is the world is still a playground, and you have no idea what's coming if you just don't ever quit and manifest hacker mentality, radical curiosity, a refusal to let somebody who builds the machine encapsulate you in it. Look at the machine to say, all right, this is what they wanted it to do, but look at what I can make it do. That's fun. And all the boundaries have gone down. From geopolitical structures all the way down to individuals. And I did a talk called When Privacy Goes Poof, Why It's Gone and Never Coming Back. And it's because the notion of privacy links to an individual. And that was an 18th century term. People don't realize that. Individual rights didn't exist. Individuals didn't exist. You look at Shakespeare's plays, he used the word individual, but it meant a unitary thing. It didn't mean a person. And it was only after the Renaissance and the Reformation and the printing press objectified text and therefore psyches that could be projected out there as if they had an external reality that individuals came to mean what we think of when I say you're an individual. Well, that's gone because other people using even data mining and AI now know you better than you can ever know yourself because they see the depth of your activity, the complexity of your patterns, things that you don't even imagine. That's why you're back here seeing yourself in your head as if you're 20th century self. And that died in the 20th century. You are an aggregate of a whole bunch of behaviors, and identity is a function, therefore, not of assertion, who you say you are, but observation. Let's watch people and see what they do. And that's how we know what they are. Well, AI is going to take that to the moon. In fact, Chinese are already on the dark side.
Well, and that right gets down to the data. I mean, at the end of the day, if we can get people to understand it's about the data and not this spooky cyber space and that type of thing, and we can get people to care about their data and a data care kind of mentality, and we start speaking to a level and making it personal, I think that's when we will actually get people to capture their imagination to realize they're not outside the game. They are the game.
Right. And it takes, as you said, it takes being gored yourself. More and more people I know, they say, oh, I don't know who that is. I don't click on it. I don't click on that link. And somebody who is an expert, like yourself, can say, well, why don't you look at the headers? Why don't you look at the metadata because there is somebody for whom that spam that you're deleting, so as you've been taught, is intended. And when they get it, they can go to the other data buried in their steganography or whatever, and get the message that is meant for them. And somebody was just telling me a piece of work they did collectively to identify spammers in relationship to terrorism, which they were serving. And it's a terrific story, really, but I can't go into all the details. But at the end, somebody said, is this group, which you outed in Vegas in some storefront, but you look in there on Sunday afternoon through the dark glass, there are all these people working. So are they still doing this? And my friend said, no, they're not, because they're all dead. And he said, I don't miss one wink of sleep knowing we have killed them all. So this is where it comes home to roost for people who play this game at a higher level. It's not just a game. There are people who are actively trying to bring us down. And we have to fight fire with fire. And that's where the grayness comes in. Right? And you have to use the tools and techniques available to you. Well, Mobius. Finish Mobius. Mobius is as true as can be.
Just for our viewers, I'm about halfway through it, and it's excellent. But this is a good segue, right? So one of the things you'd like to talk about is that the only way to tell truth is in fiction, right? The dynamics of life in the national security state. And I think that was really your impetus to write Mobius, right? Tell the least false thing.
Yeah,
into stories. So what happened there? How did that come to be?
Good question. That came out of Clapper, before Congress. And he said, I told them the least untruthful thing I could say. And I said, normal people, humplings, think that's what we call a lie. That is, you told something that wasn't true. He said, no, it was the least, gradations of truth. The bottom line is really a simple arc and a simple trajectory. I became very close to a lot of people. We shared our understanding of what it was we were mutually doing. Some of them worked for different agencies. Some of them said, there's something you could do. And I always, always gladly did it because I'm a good patriot. but also it was very interesting. And in one case, I was invited in after 9/11 to co-lead a conversation about how ethics had been transformed by EO Executive Order 12333 after 9/11. Things that were illegal are no longer illegal. Things that were unconstitutional are no longer unconstitutional. Rewrite the laws, get the courts to approve the new understanding of them. One of my friends said, if you were in the director's office when they read that executive order, the silence was so thick you could cut it with a knife. He said, because we're senior people. We can't do that. He said, when we get an order from the commander in chief, we sleep, is what we do. And it's not just Bush who issued that order. Obama is more Bush than Bush. It's the dynamics inevitably determined by the nature of cyber itself. This is what we have to do. So is there a way to frame an ethical stance, if the word ethical means anything at all? And a group of senior people decided to meet to discuss that and generate a report that would go into one of the agencies that hopefully would do some good. And it took a couple of years to do that. And I was invited to co-lead that group. So at one point, a senior person said to me, you can't ever discuss what we talk about in here unless you start writing fiction. He said, fiction is now the only way you can tell the truth. Well, that was true on a number of levels. For one thing, I taught literature. I think literature is the truest thing you can say because it does justice to the complexity and depth of our experience and the subtlety of it. But also, he was right on a different score. I'm not going to betray my friends. If you don't, right? The closer you get to a cadre of people, the more you excuse whatever devious, evil things they do. Because, that's so-and-so. He's a good guy. Yeah, he killed somebody. But you had to know the circumstances. So it became true. But I also discovered that given the nature of blowback and the way information transited from place to place, which was why boundaries were going down, because they couldn't keep out information. And information is the sea in which we all swim now, that fiction had become the way the society tells the truth to itself. And that talk of that name uses plenty of examples to show. And his professor, short-term memory, but he's a great professor. He did a book on this subject to show that it's now normative for our society to use fiction. Like Alito quoting 24, saying, you know, they're not going to, you know, nobody's going to come back on that guy for shooting a, kneecapping a terrorist if he's going to stop the bomb. Well, there's no bomb. There never is going to be a bomb. But people use that to justify. And that's what Ali North said. He said, do you think anybody's going to want to prosecute me? Where's the next microphone so I can do a talk show?
That's great. So there's a lot of stuff that's been that you kind of wove into Mobius. So you've got a couple different things we can riff on here. So one is co-opting of the media, you know, paying people in the media to you know, suppress stories or enhance stories. Just this concept of layers and layers of deception. There's a scene where an airline pilot, I don't want to give them all away, but an airline pilot sees like a facility being built in a mountain, and then like the next flight over, it's not there. So these are things I'm guessing you didn't make up.
Nothing.
Yep.
Nothing. Almost nothing, I should say, because it's fiction. Close to damn near nothing is made up in Mobius. That came from an airline pilot. He was trying to figure out why he flew down along the Wasatch Front, and he saw them building in the mountain out in the middle of nowhere. And next time he came back, you couldn't see it. And then somebody else. You see, 28 years of doing this, keynoted security conferences in 15 countries, lots of wonderful friends, colleagues, and comrades, and 28 years of conversation about this. So when somebody else tells me that they were part of the Gomer Explorer operation to try to retrieve the Soviet submarine that sank in the Pacific, and they created a cover story of we're looking for manganese modules. And so tell me about that. Well, I was the head of this part of the thing, and we would get on a plane with blacked out windows and fly to a place and get into an elevator and went down. And then we had our meetings. And they're very, just as Mobius says, very nice facilities, Coke machines, you know. And then we came up and everybody went back to where they came from. We're told not to look at anybody else. And the meeting never happened. And there were no notes or minutes, and there never are. So you don't even need to classify it. A lot of important things are just said. And Omerta is the guideline. Don't say anything. So interesting about this guy, he had to leave the program shortly before the culmination of it. And he went to someone on his team and said, what were you able to do? And he said, I'm sorry, you're not read in anymore. I said, but I headed the goddamn team. He says, doesn't matter. You'll have to wait for declassification like everybody else.
Do you think compartmentalization, you know, that's such a great tool for keeping secrets.
Yep.
I don't think civilian industry has really adopted that yet. The OPSEC and civilians not there. But that also is one of the contributors of stress, right? Not knowing what happened, not knowing the outcomes, not being able to share with other humans.
Absolutely. And even people in the game, as you know, you sound like Goodfellas. You say, hey, you know that guy? He says, who, that guy? No, not that guy, the other guy. You know the guy. Oh, that guy. Yeah, I know that guy. You learn a coded way of conversation. But everybody ultimately knows in the conversation what you're talking about if you share the connotation or the denotation of the connotations you're using to try to talk about it. But it creates cognitive dissonance. It really does. You have to live with a high level of dissonance and handle ambiguity and complexity at a level that most people don't want. And that's why often people will get up in one of my speeches and say, I don't want to know that. I don't want to live in your world. I said, well, you live in it, whether you want to know about it or not. This is the world. And don't forget Ellsberg, when he was briefing Henry Kissinger on higher clearances he was going to get, SCI clearances. He said, Henry, you need to know that the trauma that is going to come once you get clearances is that nothing you have believed is true. You have read the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and they don't know. They can't know, and they don't know. And you're going to find out that you interacted with an awful lot of people who knew and never told you. And for a long time, you're not going to think it's worthwhile to talk to anybody without clearances. But that's a dead end, because in a few years, you'll find out you're excluding a vast ocean of information. And now I think it's becoming a truism, right? That open source intelligence, given the abilities we all have to be investigative, journalist spies, whatever, open source intelligence and AI to mine it properly, is generating so much intelligence, so much actionable intelligence and real understanding of people, which, as you said before, is what we want out of intelligence. You don't just want to know stuff. You want to know the intention of the person you're trying to map. And you are trying to map everybody. You know, and then that's a true story in Mobius too, when the liaison with the Brits said in the director's office, you know, we ought to take special care with the Brits. They're our friends and our allies. And Deputy Director Sagan said, excuse me, we have no friends. We have no allies. We have targets. It's all we have. So every once in a while, the French and the Germans will squeal and say, oh, God, you hacked our premiers. Duh. Everybody is doing that to everybody, spy versus spy, right?
Well, so, and it takes a look back at time and mostly time and information that becomes revealed that was hidden before,
right?
That really starts solidifying and opening our eyes. And specifically, one of the things that I love talking to you about is all the history and activity of the UFO and the government. And, you know, here we were part of a conversation and somebody, it's no problem to realize the government lied to us about UFOs back in the 40s and 50s. Right. But to think that the government is lying to us today about the pandemic or COVID or politics seems still to be a barrier by certain people. So it's an interesting dynamic that people are so easy on one side to believe that we don't know the truth, yet on the other, we're only being told the truth.
Right. And one of the things where I just kind of get my brain caught in the gears and then it just spins is when I look at what I think these people are crazy. How can they be so stupid as to distrust the government? And then I look at what I've written and what I speak about. And it's, if you're not distrusting the government, you're crazy. So you have to live with both worlds at the same time, simultaneously, and hold them both in your head at the same time. I'm doing a sequel to Mobius. The full title for those who are listening is Mobius, A Memoir. It's a story of an intelligence professional looking back at his career and how it took him where he didn't think he would go. And I'm proud to say that people from behind the fence, number fences, have just been over the top in the kind of reviews they're giving this for its verisimilitude. And now I'm doing a sequel to Mobius. And it's going to explore corporate, a particular corporate. And I live in Minneapolis, which happens to be the headquarters of a large medical device manufacturer. Start looking at them and look at how the government, all the governments globally, which I'm getting quite familiar with, give passes or buys to stuff that's killing people.
And there's some really good comments on reviews for the book. This is Richard Thieme's best work to date. This book is intense. Read it if you want to learn the inner thoughts of a spy. Richard Thieme's Mobius is written on at least three levels of rhetoric. So it's just really, really good comments. But one of the things that comes out of Mobius is the fact that there is no one government. So if we're talking about trusting the government, people right. always feel like, well, how come they didn't know? I called my local state police. How does right. the NSA not know, right?
Right, right. And a lot of people don't know and don't know that they don't know or what they don't know. And it's very uncomfortable to not know, but know that you don't know. And so you make it up. And here you have conspiracy theories because we want to connect the dots. And we see a very few dots and we say, oh, it's a bear in the sky. No, it might be a lion, might be a goat or a sheep. Whatever it is, we prematurely connect the dots because our pattern matching, making minds want to connect dots and understand what we're seeing. And I talked to a wonderful profiler at CIA once who gave me a complete description of how she has to prevent herself from reaching conclusions too soon and what kind of safeguards she has to constantly build in, because your brain will leap to conclusions that are very, very often incorrect, premature at any rate. And she really knew what she was talking about. She was given a great award medal in the director's office of CIA. She came in the office, he gave it to her, said, "This was really a good job." She said, "Thank you," and then he took it back. So she can't tell anybody why she got the medal or keep the medal. But there was a moment of medal touching. And a lot of us, you know, have moments of metal touching, right? And that's a lot of what my work has been about. But after 25 years of listening to people, not only what it did to professionals, but what it was doing to me. And that goes all the way back to when I was learning about the torture we were doing. And I was trying to get medical experts to look at what we were doing, because it violated an awful lot of things, including laws. Nobody would touch it. I went to the chief ethicist at the AMA, who I knew, went down to Chicago. And he said, "We don't bother with that." I said, "But can I tell you what we're doing?" So I went to a woman who headed a committee at the medical college, and she said, "You really need to read these books on trauma." So I did. And next time I saw her, she said, "Do you know why I told you to read them?" And I said, "Sure, because I'm talking to people who both tortured and were tortured, who were traumatized. And it wasn't in the news yet." And she said, "Yeah, can you think of another reason I wanted you to read it?" And I said, "No, because denial is our best friend. And if we knew we were in denial, we wouldn't be in denial, because we'd know that about which we were in denial, and we don't." So she said, "You're traumatized. You're showing all the symptoms of secondary trauma by having these conversations with people." So the narrative that poured out, it took 4 months to write the first draft. And then I did a lot of editing because I wanted it just right. But it just poured out. 25 years of assimilating emotion. Some of it profoundly impactful. The phone rings at 10 o'clock at night, just like in the ministry. And somebody says, "You got a minute?" And an hour later, he says, "What should I do?" And I said, "You know what to do, but my job is not to tell you what to do. All I can do is illuminate the options, and you've got to make the choice about what you're going to do." It was a life and death decision he'd been asked to do on behalf of a particular group. Then I get off the phone, and my wife says, "You look like you've seen a ghost. What was that about?" And I say, "Oh, nothing. Just like everybody in the trade learns to say, no, it's no big deal. But it has an impact over time. So Mobius, c'est moi, as Flaubert said of Madame Bovary. Madame Bovary, c'est moi. It is me. It is me. It's my psyche. And it's spliced with a million points of data that friends and colleagues have shared with me over the last quarter century. And I hope I did justice to the complexity of the situation in which people find themselves. Because the truth is, Mobius arrives at a certain point, but he loves his work. And he loves the elite status it gives him. I think it was Ellsberg who said, "There's no high like secrets."
So when's Mobius 2 going to be available?
Well, I just start going on it. It'll be a while. I don't know. But what a creative person does is start hearing the voices in their head from other rooms. You thought you shut off that room in the mansion, but suddenly, if you don't pay attention to those voices, they become haunted. And pretty soon at night, they're scratching on the window and they're in the basement and you're waking up in the middle of the night.
Maybe you should just write shorter poetry. It sounds like you've got an Edgar Allan Poe streak going there with the scratching and the other things. Maybe just short little...
It's just me. That's my life. That's my psyche.
Anybody offered to buy the book rights yet?
Pardon me?
Anybody offered to buy the book rights for Mobius yet?
Oh, you mean the movie rights?
Yeah.
Movie.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story. And I, what it takes to get published when a publisher will not speak to you and an agent will not speak to you, and then you're disparaged for quote self-publishing. It's not a vanity press. No publisher will speak to an author, period. They will only speak to agents. And the agents I was able to contact, maybe 10% of the couple of hundred I tried to contact, so the young women straight from an MFA, very well-intentioned, so I'm just building a list. Truthfully, Ron, they didn't know what the hell Mobius was about. It's way beyond their pay grade of understanding of life, but they never got that far. They just didn't know what to do with it. And it's like when Barnes & Noble called and said, you know, you could do a reading for us. What's your niche for the book? And I said, well, it's for people who like to think deeply about things. No. He said, is it for young males, 18 to 25? Is it for soccer moms? I said, it's for young males who like to think deeply about things. It's for soccer moms who like to think deeply about things. They said, we don't have a category for thinking deeply about things. We don't have that demographic on our spreadsheet. And so somebody like me, who has always been true to his vision and worked in accordance with it from the inside out and noticed and paid attention to what other people were saying, but didn't let it determine my life. I mean, the evidence is in. I've been a self-actualizing kind of human for 77 years, and I hope I don't stop for another 77. We can get to work on telomeres and stop my telomeres from shortening.
Well, I believe you when you say that Mobius is not you, but the person on the cover, I'm sure if I got a picture of you from maybe, I don't know, your 20s or 30s, it would look a little bit like that person on the cover.
Yeah, no, that was my dear friend. I mean, friends have come out of the woodwork to make this book look as good as it did. And that was my friend Harvey Tillis, who was a photographer. We met in sixth grade and have been friends ever since. And I said, you got anything I could use for a cover? Well, we worked and worked and worked on it. I said, this guy is perfect. So we found the rainy corner in Chicago and found that guy. And then he put in those eyes, which are obviously my eyes, because Mobius is always confronting people with who, you know, several people wrote to me, know me for years. Who are you? You know, what have you been doing? Well, of course, nobody knows what anybody else has been doing. Right.
So on that too, I mean, other people have been writing science fiction and other, you know, this is a cyber fiction show. Yeah. So, you know, what other science fiction things has been?
What kind of things influence you?
It's usually not science fiction. I pick it up and, you know, I was on a podcast the other day, Pop and Lock, and they're well into popular culture. And I said, look, the movies are opening at the AMC across the street. And they're all cartoons and comic books. And they're kind of offended, you know, because they're not comic books, they're graphic novels. They're not cartoons, they're anime. It's no, it's cartoons and comic books. There's not a movie there for a mature adult, like the great 70s movies that we had. They wouldn't make them. We're talking about The Conversation, the movie The Conversation. They wouldn't make The Conversation today. They wouldn't make Chinatown. They wouldn't make The Parallax View. It wouldn't touch that stuff now. So I find an awful lot of what's on the shelf under science fiction is fantasy. It's serialized because those who make Kindles found that as soon as you finish one segment, you click and buy the next. And that's why you're getting so many 3, 4, 5, 6 episode novelizations cranked out. It's a commercial project. I used to read science fiction all the time when I was a kid. Clifford D. Simak, Heinlein, Asimov, you know, people like that. But a lot of young people don't even know who those people are. They're reading Game of Thrones and George R. R. Martin stuff that I pick up. And I say, because very often, even good technology novels, they splice two things. They have really good, like, is it Suarez who writes those great novels? The technology in them, like Singers, is really informative. But then they're trying to write a novel and they don't know how to write a novel. They don't know how to create real people. So the literature part, the prose part, and the vehicle for disseminating data about technology are separate. And so I usually skip through the dialogues, which are wooden, to get the technology that they're trying to impart. Like a guy like Singer knows an awful lot about future war and weaponry. But I read a great deal of diversity. I read a lot of, because of UFOs, I've been exploring that. We haven't talked about it much for 43 years. I read an awful lot on cosmology, on astronomy. I do an awful lot of reading in physics, but it's physics without the math. You know, there's some people who are really good at explaining to people like me who can't do the math. And who can? I mean, who can do quantum physics at that level? Well, very few people, and then they can't talk to the rest of us. So I read an extraordinary diversity of stuff, like Peter Singer, found him, read everything he wrote. I do that with a lot of people. And I have guilty pleasures, like James Lee Burke. I think his prose on Louisiana is the best, some of the best I've seen. But it's formulaic, and he just keeps kind of repeating. But I've read all 27 of his novels because some of it is so beautiful. And I go back again and again to the things I loved that I taught in literature that nobody reads. I read Ulysses. I read Scott Fitzgerald. Even read some of the Hemingway short stories, like Big Two-Hearted River. I read poetry. Good old poetry, like Wordsworth, Eliot's Four Quartets. Things that were foundational for me in thinking this is how these works are to be written. And a lot of people don't know who these old dead white guys are anymore.
Before they're all banned, at least, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to have Mobius attacked.
Oh, maybe we can make that happen. We'll see.
Do something controversial with Mobius. Did you just disappear on me?
Yeah, our camera for some reason just went off.
Well, I see we're probably at the time where we probably be
wanting to go. I think there are other powers have been telling
B
us
here.
That perhaps we should.
They didn't want me to. Didn't want me to tell. Right?
That's right. I was going to ask you where the secret alien, you know, Kennedy tapes, where Elvis's brain and, you know, the clone Hitler and all that kind of stuff is at. But Richard, let's just close out with, how can people find you if they want you to come and speak? You know, are you speaking yet? Let's just close out with how.
I was supposed to be in Vegas today, but my pre-recorded talk for DEF CON is being streamed on Friday on UFOs, which they requested. I'm supposed to go to Corn Con and speak at a North Carolina conference on teaching cyber education. Those are supposed to be in September, but life today means you wait and see if those things really happen. You can do them on Zoom. Done a lot of speaking on Zoom. The best place to find me is my website, ThemeWorks, ThemeWorks.com. Got 50 speeches or so up there linked. Everything new goes up there. The books are up there. I believe it's a well done. We just revamped the whole damn thing. It took months, of course, but I hadn't done it for 20 years. It was a little out of date.
There's a lot of gems on there. Like you interviewed the astronaut, Edgar Mitchell about UFOs and going to the moon. And I'll just give that as a thing people can go find on your website to get them over there.
That and Joe McMonagle, the remote viewer. Those are two of my very favorite interviews. I used to do a lot of interviews. McMonagle on remote viewing and what it taught him about the universe. Even if you don't believe it, it's mind stretching in the right directions. It's good stuff.
That's awesome. Well, Richard, all our best to you. Congratulations on Mobius. We're looking forward to Mobius 2 and the movie that's going to be coming out on HBO. Yeah,
talk to your friends in Hollywood. Tell them. I mean, or your comic book makers. Tell them.
Graphic novels. I mean,
yeah. It's wonderful awesome. To talk to you guys, to have a privileged hour with the two of you who are luminaries in the field. And so remove yourselves from the foreground in order to draw out other people on this podcast is a gift and a kind of humility that is not always in evidence. And you're doing wonderful work with your foundation. People don't know where to begin saying thank you for all the people you're helping. So this is a privilege, and thank you so much.
It's our privilege. I mean, we're blessed to know people like you, and we really do want people to share their stories, because it is just amazing background work, and just always blows my mind with how we got where we are and where we're going.
Yeah.
And, looking forward to what's going on in the future.
Me too. And I guess our next podcast will start any minute. So
that's right. All righty. So thank you, Richard. This is Ron and Cindy Gula signing off with another episode of the Gula Tech Cyber Fiction Show. And hitting stop recording.